To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black Bess. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 689 of Unwelcome Guests, A Tale of Two Worlds. I'm Robin Upton, and this week, stark contrast, most of the show we're going to be hearing some details of the deep state and how they pulled off 9-1-1. I can't seem to put that topic down, can I? But we're going to start with some uplifting material, a tale of a man I met once in Bangladesh, whom you probably won't have heard of because he doesn't court publicity. He doesn't do much, actually, except for focus on his mission, which is to build bridges. These are basically single-span, large steel suspension bridges, not for cars, but for people or bicycles. He's never built any in Bangladesh because he needs rock to use as an anchor, and just decided that Bangladesh wasn't a practical country for this design. But he does build in nearby Myanmar, and when this email came about a recent set of bridges that he'd been building there, I thought, I'm going to read this on the show, because he's exemplifying, even in today's world, the world of the future that I see, which is people working together on projects that they're genuinely interested in, embracing a spirit of abundance, and working in the gift. A bridge journey through Myanmar. Here in Kyabin, it is 6 o'clock in the morning. The sun's rising, and with Aiklian, my Shan Burmese colleague, we're beginning the final assembly of our bridge number 73 in Myanmar and 651 in the world. We're on a typical bridge assembly journey, which means putting up 7 bridges within 12 days, travelling included. It's not that we're rushing. For us, it's the natural flow of work. While we're finishing one bridge, a delegation sent from the villages at the next location is already there. They're waiting to take us with them, and that's how we're passed on from village to village across Myanmar. From here, in the northwest of the country, near the Indian border, we'll cross to the northeast, near China, from there down to Magway in the southwest, and finally back to Yangon, approximately 2,000 kilometres. At each location, hundreds of families are waiting to see their bridge finished. Several weeks ago, they already did the most laborious part. They collected sand and stones, dug the ground, and carried the steel structures. Once everything's ready, my colleague Aiklian showed up for a few days, and with him they did the concrete works. Then, for 3 weeks, they waited patiently for the concrete to cure. Meanwhile, they had time to repaint all steel plates and frames, and to complete the access ramps. These can be huge, especially in areas with dangers of floods in the monsoon. There the towers are mounted on top of the bridgeheads, up to 6 meters high. The day of magic. Yesterday we put up the towers and main cables of this first bridge, a nice one with 100 meter span. Now everything is ready. People can't believe that this afternoon their suffering because of the river will be over. They say it's like magic. Aiklian is giving them the morning speech on safety and our procedures. In a few minutes, I'll sit with him on the plank laid across both main cables, which is our working platform. Then we'll be pulled up to the top of the tower by ropes and strong peasant arms. From there, we'll move steadily along the main cables until we reach the other tower. On the way, we'll hook up each hanger cable at its specified position. The men below bring the next hanger cable with its bridge deck frame and the next steel plate. Other men fix the bolts. About every 6 minutes, we continue forward another 2 meters, so it will take us about 5 hours for a bridge of 100 meters. The beginning is always a little slow until the peasants learn the steps. It will be extremely hot, typical for this region of Myanmar, in April and May. The radio said it will be 43 degrees Celsius, but 15 meters up in the air with a slight breeze, it could be a little less. This is just the first of a series of 7 bridges. The emotions along such a journey go up and down, understandably. You can only do this with a mentally and emotionally stable partner. Generally, you live the happiness to serve so many people and in such a short time. But you also live the merciless heat, the rains and mud in the rainy season, the unsound sleep in always different places, the back-breaking travelling, the inevitable technical and human problems. But right now I feel all right, and this afternoon I will feel even better, when this biggest and most difficult one of the series will be finished. Walking on water. We started at 7 in the morning, and the assembly was completed at noon. Handrails in place, and the clean-up finished about 3 in the afternoon. The people did great, as they so often do here. The heat was overwhelming. During those 5 hours sitting up on the plank, the peasant ladies continuously sent us up plastic bottles of coconut water with a little lemon juice. We each drank 5 liters of coconut water in 5 hours, and no need to go to the toilet. The human body is amazing. I often wonder at it, so I try to make the best use of it that I can imagine, bending down and putting up bridges. Time has come to bid farewell. That's how it is in a bridge builder's life. Say hello, work with people, say goodbye. Many smile, others have tears in their eyes. Usually they present us with what they have. Bottles full of wild honey or sesame oil, fruits, peanuts, beans, a new shirt or lungi, in a village of elephant drivers, a beautiful blue piece of cloth to make me a new bag. In a village of woodworkers, a reclining seat made of precious wood, if for one day I should have somewhere to put it. As is my habit, I say my own private goodbye to the Argentinian pipes and the Swiss cables. Today they begin their new life here, in this distant place. I feel as if I'm leaving behind a part of myself, and it touches me as if for the first time. Will people take care of you? Will they see your beauty and love you for what you stand for, as I do? Here nobody knows where these pipes and cables were born, who created them. Nor do they know who midwifed their delivery into the country on a complicated journey across the seas and through international customs, or how in our workshop we formed them, with skill and much care, so that, united as a bridge, they will be able to face their lifelong task, to stand strong and serve every human and animal that comes their way. Today they will hear the children run below and shout overjoyed, "Look, I'm walking on the water!" Means of transport. A journey of bridges requires precise but also flexible coordination, so that time after time Eichlin and myself, but especially hundreds of peasants, manage to meet at their respective bridge site on the right day at the right time. The delegates carry us on the vehicles they manage to find, often in the car of the local monastery's chief monk, or of a merchant, or on some old truck, or at a minimum on small motorcycles. This makes a string of 10 motorcycles, for all the bags with tools, bolts, clips, and so we cross mountains and forests for hours. For the long-distance stages we use public transport, for example on the mighty rivers Ayeyo Wadi or Chinwin. We use public boats, sometimes 10 or more hours of sailing. In past years we used the old railway too, especially from Mandalay going north towards places in Sagaing and Kachin state, but now better roads are being built and better buses extend their service reach. So nowadays it's mostly what we call bridge building by bus, which has numerous advantages. It's very efficient and economical, with drivers who know their road, without costs nor headaches for vehicle maintenance, no Ministry of Transport permits or license plate renewals. In this large country, the bus trips are frequently 14 hours or more. On a day bus, I try to do some administrative work on the laptop, as far as 2 batteries can hold up, with music in my ears to drown out the obnoxious TV shows. On a night bus, I use the time to think, or catch a little sleep. the people's effort. I highly respect the peasants for the efforts they make. I don't tire of pointing out, especially in the West, that these bridges are built by the peasants. They clear the land, dig the ground, and break the rock, all with the tools they use in their fields. Machetes, axes, hoes, shovels, hammers, and pickaxes. By hand, they collect 120 to 400 tons of sand, gravel, and stone, depending on the bridge. But not all communities are lucky to find the required sand or stone in their river, so some have to go and buy it, sometimes from several hours away. This can cost up to 2 million Myanmar kyats, that's about $2,000. In this country, unlike the peasants in Indonesia and Ecuador, they don't have a generous Holcim cement factory to help them with the cement. They have to buy it. 500 bags for one of the largest bridges can cost up to $3,500. They also find a truck to bring their entire bridge kit from Yangon, where we do the prefabrication. This transport can cost from $300 to $3,000. To illustrate it a bit more, the distance from Yangon to the most faraway villages is as far as it is from Italy to Poland, or Ecuador to Venezuela. Ideally, we coordinate the timing to put two or three bridges on a single truck to the same region, so we can share the costs among the villages. We load all the components without mix-ups or the kits or missing anything. At the end of the entire series, we put the remaining 200 kilo of tools into the cargo hold of a bus and return to Yangon. So, for a 100-meter span bridge, in the most distant and unfavorable case, the villagers may spend up to $10,000. This is an enormous amount of money for them, but large bridges like this in Myanmar serve 2,000 households or more. They collect the money among all the families who benefit from the bridge. Many give $3 to $5, the equivalent of about 2 days of work. Those better off and who want to do a good deed donate more. Sometimes a merchant in a nearby town makes a donation. Usually the monks help too, and a lot. We don't know how, but the people always manage to gather everything, and we just hear their stories afterwards. For example, the villagers of the second bridge of this series couldn't find a truck from their remote area, so they went and hired one in Yangon. Bad idea. To their sorrow, after about 80% of the 3-day journey, in the forest somewhere north of Monya, the Yangon driver finally refused to continue on this horrible and unknown road. The unfortunate village delegates had no choice but to go find a crane plus another truck to offload and reload the 20 tons in the middle of the forest. Or here at Khyaw Bin, the current Minister of Industry in Myanmar has some relationship with the area. He donated from his own pocket the cement for the bridge and the transportation costs. No show, no name, just a good deed. Precisely like all those who in some way contribute to the bridges, just like the most modest peasant, with the strength of his muscles and his $3. The right-hand man. It's worth a thought. No family, no demands, no profit. Instead, total dedication and service. What kind of man lives like this, not only for a month, but for many years? And in what circumstances? Ike Lian is such a man, and he's been my right-hand man here in Myanmar since I started here 6 years ago. Knowing both the Shan and Burmese languages, he can talk with the villagers of the entire country, and they respect him. He's 41 years old, still single, and doesn't want to take a salary. Without even asking, he receives all he needs along the way from peasants, from our friends in the cities, or from Swiss families who've been helping us from the beginning. With the experience gained at my side over the years, Ike Lian now does much alone. Imagine this one inconspicuous man, alone on a bus crisscrossing Myanmar over and over again. Because of such a man, now 500,000 Myanmar citizens have a better life. Every tour I do, he does 3 times. First he goes to check the sites and their topography and talk with the villagers. The second time he goes for concrete works. The third time he's with me for the final assembly. But many trips are in vain. For each bridge we do build, we probably look up to about 3 locations where we can't build, depending on the country and province. The main criteria are the commitment of the villagers, the number of villages served, topography, and transport. Aiklian has been to all regions of Myanmar, and there to the last corners. I would say that few people in the country know its entire geography as extensively as he does. But why does a man lead such a life, day in, day out, patiently, brave, consistently? Some day I will tell his astonishing story. A letter in Mandalay. We've arrived in Mandalay, after having put up the first three bridges. Tomorrow we'll take the bus to the northeastern part of the country, the northern Shan state bordering with China. Here in Mandalay they have internet, and among the mails is one from the Minister of Industry, who gave his help for the bridge built just 4 days ago. He's somehow gotten my email address to send me his letter from the capital near Phi Tho. Dear Tony, this letter is written with emotion and my heart playing a melody. And further down, the villagers will definitely be grateful and keep you in their deepest heart whenever they use the bridge. I don't know how many hundreds of letters I've written to ministers or other government authorities in 13 countries over the past 27 years, requesting all sorts of permissions or help, but I've never received such a heartfelt letter by a minister. A missed opportunity. It doesn't happen often to me, and maybe once or twice per country, and today it happened here in Myanmar. At 8 in the morning, we reached the bridge site about 2 hours from Lashio. The steel plates and frames were laid out, but only halfway painted. The formwork and sandbags had not been removed, and most importantly, no people around, not one peasant. Of course, Aiklian had notified them for today's final assembly, but for some crazy reason the people seemed not to care. So we did what we do in such a situation. We waited an hour while someone went to drum up the people. About 20 showed up, when we need at least 80. We reminded them that this was an agreement of honour. We make our effort and the people make theirs. We don't waste time, theirs or ours. For tomorrow in Magwe Division another bridge is waiting with hundreds of people, and the next day another one. They were a bit surprised, and they thought we were just posturing. Then the few local officials tried to justify and talk us over. Then they just remained sad. We'll come back in a few weeks or months, after taking care of the other bridges in the queue. The last of 7. Yesterday noon, we reached Minbu with the night bus from Lashio. And today, at 11 in the morning, we completed number 6. Near the mountain range between Magwe Division and Rakhine Division in western Myanmar. From there the villagers carried us on their little truck for 2 hours to the 7th and last bridge of this trip. There the next villagers were eagerly waiting, maybe 200 men, women and children. The same afternoon we measured, marked, crossed to the other side, lifted up and anchored the main cables. Now, from 7 in the evening until 9 o'clock, we're cutting the hanger cables, right here by the riverside. This careful process takes about 2 hours. The people brought a small generator and lights. I mark the lengths, while Aiklian binds off and cuts each of the 36 hanger cables. I always have about 3 minutes in between. I use them to write a few more lines, 36 times. Tomorrow, at about 2 in the afternoon, we should be finished here, and in the evening we'll take one more night bus to Yangon. 6 of 7 bridges completed, 35,000 people served. Whatever you do, Gandhi once wrote, in the grand scheme of things it's insignificant, but it's still absolutely vital that you do it. I keep wondering about the very rare opportunity it is to be on this planet, how very short and precious our time we have here, the bridges made of gifts and of leftovers, of love and common sacrifice, of so many, express my highest wish. I am human. I want to be worthy of it. Now that PDF is available on our website if you want to see some beautiful pictures of smiling villagers and impressive steel suspension bridges. Now, from the magnanimous abundant world that I would work towards, let's return to looking at the old world of self-interest and Machiavellian calculation, looking particularly at the deep state actors involved in the 911 operation. Many thanks to Bonnie Faulkner, who carried out this interview in August 2013. She's been working in the GIFT for years, producing Guns and Butter and making that show available to everybody, posting it on the web. So if you have some money to donate to her, I suspect she would appreciate it. And just before I play the interview, a thought for those of you who are doubtful about giving up money, a vote for keeping the money system in anything like its present form is a vote for keeping the entrenched privilege and the power of the people that Kevin Ryan refers to and all the Machiavellian overworld, those people for whom monetary self-interest is a primary goal.
What is the basic concept behind your new book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects? The U.S. government named 19 individuals, mostly Saudis, of instigating the events of September 11th, 2001. You have written a book about 19 high-level government, corporate, and intelligence officials whose behavior for decades before September 11th calls into question their involvement in these events. In your introduction to the book, you mention, quote, the politically minded rich, a group otherwise referred to as the overworld, and the connections between important operations such as the October Surprise, Iran-Contra, Operation Gladio, the First Gulf War, and 9/11. In your research, do you find the same individuals popping up in all of these events?
Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of what I'm trying to show here. After learning about 9/11 and the history of other deep state events, I've found that those events have a lot of people that seem to pop in and out of history and show up in things. You mentioned Iran-Contra. I also go through the Phoenix program in Vietnam a little bit. Another big one are the lies behind the First Gulf War. And so the reason I wrote the book is that many people know now that the official investigations and the official reports for 9/11 don't explain some of the major aspects of what happened. They really have not been sufficient in explaining the unanswered questions. And I go through some of those. I focus on what has not been explained and who might have been in position to accomplish the parts of the attacks that have not been explained. And in doing so, as you said, I found that these people seem to be interlaced and interwoven with history of other state crimes and other deep state events. So I go into quite a bit of detail in the book, and it's for people who really want to learn more about 9/11, are really interested in the subject.
How did investigations in the 1970s into CIA crimes, such as assassinations of political leaders around the world, known as the family jewels, lead to the formation of a private covert network of intelligence operatives? What can you tell us about the history of this private network that formed in the late 70s and how that history developed?
Well, the history goes back, as you said, to the mid-70s when the CIA was under fire publicly by several congressional investigations. And there were legal actions taken, and there were tools put in place for the public to try to control these agencies, the CIA in particular. And what happened as a result of that, with the blessing of then CIA Director George H.W. Bush, is that some of the people who were working in the U.S. intelligence service connected with foreign intelligence services, like that of the Saudi government, and like that of a group called the Safari Club, which included the Saudis and the Iranians and other countries. And they found ways to act as proxies around the world for each other. So essentially, the CIA was prohibited from doing certain things, from conducting certain operations after these congressional investigations. And so what they did is they essentially contracted the work out covertly. It was off-the-books operations. And a big part of that, the need for funding came about in a way that created something called the Bank of Commerce and Credit International. And actually, this bank existed, but it was developed by the Saudis at the request of a man named Carp Clifford, who was a high-level, powerful person in the United States. And the BCCI became essentially a terrorist financing network. And as you read through the book, Another 19, you see many links to BCCI, and they're very compelling in terms of the ability for people to, for example, place explosives in the World Trade Center. The company that's most likely to have been able to do that was a company called Stratesec, and I go into great detail about that and the company's links to BCCI. And anyway, this network was essentially a covert operations network funded through this terrorist financing group called BCCI, which was basically run by the CIA through its work, was very closely linked to the Bush family. Many people have written about this in the past. I'm certainly not the first one. In my book, it really is just kind of laying the history that others have already covered and showing how that history links very well to various aspects of the 9/11 attacks.
The first two persons that you give a detailed history of are Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Let's start with Donald Rumsfeld. What do we know about him? And didn't he on several occasions make prescient predictions about the 9/11 attacks?
Oh, yes, absolutely he did. Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld in this book are essentially the alternative Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They are the two people who were in perfect position to coordinate the attacks of 9/11 because of their roles. For Dick Cheney as Vice President of the United States, he was in charge at the White House that day with the President traveling around the country indisposed. And Donald Rumsfeld, as the Secretary of Defense, was in position at the Pentagon to coordinate what happened there and the lack of national air defenses. Donald Rumsfeld is a character who has been described by Richard Nixon as a ruthless little bastard, and he kept that reputation throughout his career. One thing about Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney is that they were in government periodically over years, but throughout the 30 years before 9/11, they were part of a group called the Continuity of Government Group. It's a secret. It was a secret group that planned to basically ensure that the government continued without, unfortunately, congressional approval. They would basically take over the government in a coup if a certain national emergency occurred. At first, those emergencies were based around the a threat of a Soviet attack on the United States. And that, in the late 90s, was revised. That plan was revised so that this COG plan, this continuity of government plan, would be in response to a terrorist event as well. And now, the interesting thing is this plan was revised by another member of the very small group that was responsible for it, and that member was a man named Richard Clark, who was a close associate of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. But as I said, Donald Rumsfeld was in perfect position to coordinate certain parts of the attack, and what he really did is he apparently allowed the attacks to go forward, and he had, it seemed, some knowledge that they were going to attack the Pentagon. He made that kind of prediction, as you said. He made these very prescient predictions, saying that this would be a great, essentially this would be an excellent place to attack he made several comments about the need for a new Pearl Harbor and that he expected a Pearl Harbor to occur. And so he made himself, unfortunately for him, I think in historical terms, that he's going to continue to look like someone who really needs to be investigated for his possible involvement in the attacks.
What can you tell us about the history of Donald Rumsfeld? He has quite a varied history, doesn't he? Starting, like you say, 30, 40 years ago.
Absolutely. He initially worked for an investment brokerage called A.G. Becker. And that was kind of his stepping stone into Congress. And he was elected to Congress after having taken a job with A.G. Becker for a year or two. And he was in Congress for a period of time, and he was a close associate of Gerald Ford, who ended up becoming president after Richard Nixon resigned. And Donald Rumsfeld, just prior to that, prior to Ford becoming president, in the few years before that, he was somehow made a special assistant to President Nixon. So he seemed to get very strong favorite treatment from the government. Somehow he was made part of the cabinet and a special assistant to President Nixon, and then he hired on Dick Cheney to be his assistant. And the two of them really skyrocketed politically in terms of just getting this favored treatment, this ability to somehow just rise through the ranks and gain power over a period of time in the Nixon and Ford administrations. Donald Rumsfeld was the ambassador to NATO, and this was at the height of the Operation Gladio crimes. And what people should know is that the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, working through NATO, was the person who was in charge of the operation. The Operation Gladio crimes were being committed by a CIA-linked group that were led by the NATO commander in Brussels. And at that same time, Donald Rumsfeld was the ambassador to NATO in Brussels. So it's not necessarily definitive that Donald Rumsfeld was somehow involved in Operation Gladio. But there are other connections with regard to Operation Gladio. And some of these suspects, Paul Bremer was strongly connected to Alexander Haig, who was also one of those Supreme Allied commanders who would have been in charge of Operation Gladio at the time. And one thing I mentioned in my book, that of the 19 suspects that I've identified, at least half of them worked in some way for the Nixon or Ford administrations, and that's when these CIA crimes were being revealed and the congressional investigations were going on, and Cheney and Rumsfeld were really defending the CIA as White House representatives. And these other people, Carlucci, for example, and Richard Clark and Paul Bremer and Rudy Giuliani were all working in the Ford and Nixon administrations. And so they all seem to tie together going back to this history of when the CIA crimes were being revealed and this new network was being developed.
Both Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney are readily identified as part of the Ford administration. But in fact, as you pointed out, the first administration that the two of them worked in was Nixon's. What was the reason for including Dick Cheney in the other 19?
Well, Dick Cheney was, as I said, he was really in charge at the White House. He was the man who originally took charge in the Underground Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or PEOC. And so a piece of evidence that many 9/11 investigators have focused on is the testimony of Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta. And there's some controversy about when Vice President Cheney actually arrived in the PEOC Center and therefore was in control of what was going on in the response that basically failed. Norman Mineta's testimony suggested that not only was Dick Cheney there very early before 9:30 in the morning, but he had given orders of some kind. And a young man was coming in periodically and checking to see if those orders still stood. The orders related to a plane that was coming towards Washington that Mineta stated was the plane that was said to have hit the Pentagon, Flight 77. So Dick Cheney was in charge of the White House. He was apparently giving orders. And by the way, Norman Mineta has stood by that testimony over the years, that Dick Cheney was tracking this plane in some way and had given orders about it. We're not sure what kind of orders. All this contradicts the official account. And Dick Cheney has also, early this year, come out and made it clear that he really was in charge, and he was basically telling the president to stay away from Washington. And, you know, many people have noted that Dick Cheney seems to have given an order to shoot down the fourth plane, United 93. So I go into a good deal of the evidence related to those things and also the background of Dick Cheney. You know, one thing about Dick and Don, as I call them in the book, and those are their names, but basically we know for a fact that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were behind the lies that started the Iraq War. They led a campaign, a coordinated campaign of lies to start the Iraq War by falsely claiming that Iraq was somehow associated with 9/11, and the Niger documents about the yellow cake were forged, and the aluminum tubes that they talked about to the New York Times, that was all false. So Dick and Don lied to start this huge war that killed a million people. Plus, Dick was also behind the lies that started the first Gulf War. And he was behind, along with another suspect in this book, his protege, Duane Andrews, he was behind the lies about the satellite imagery that said that Saddam Hussein had huge numbers of troops at the Saudi border. That was false, it turned out. He was also apparently associated with the Hill and Knowlton campaign that encouraged this young woman, Naira al-Sabah, to falsely claim that Iraqi soldiers were taking babies out of incubators. The interesting thing about Naira is she's the first cousin of one of the other suspects she's the first cousin of Michelle al-Sabah of Kawam Corporation. And he worked closely with Work Walker, who was another of the suspects. So all this ties together to a great degree. And Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld over the years appear to have been intimately involved in a number of these crimes.
Well, you also point out in your book that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld would move in and out of government, and they would publicly lose power, but really behind the scenes remain in power. You mentioned continuity of government, for one thing. Could you talk a little bit about what these two were up to when they didn't actually even hold public office?
Yes, absolutely. Dick Cheney was actually in government for a longer period of time. He was in Congress as a congressman from Wyoming not long after he left the Ford administration. One thing interesting about that little segue for his career is that he worked again for a company called Bradley Woods. And yet another of the suspects in this book now works closely with his partner, Bruce Bradley from Bradley Woods. And that's Barry McDaniel of Stratesec. But Dick Cheney worked in the government for a long period of time until the early 90s. And then he was hired as the CEO of Halliburton, a company that profited a great deal off of the wars that have resulted from 9/11. He also, as CEO of Halliburton, was clearly breaking the law in terms of doing business with Iran and Iraq and some of the countries that supposedly are the enemies of the United States. Donald Rumsfeld has been an executive for a number of companies. And he was the youngest Secretary of Defense during the Ford administration, and then one of the oldest as George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. In between, though, he held a lot of different pseudo-government positions, you know, as kind of the special envoy to the Middle East for Reagan, and also as the RAND Corporation CEO, the RAND Corporation being kind of a policy-making pseudo-private corporation associated with the Pentagon. And as you said, we discussed earlier, Dick and Don were all through this time part of this COG group, continuity of government, where they were essentially practicing to take over the United States government in time of crisis. The only time that that plan was ever implemented was on 9/11 by Richard Clark, one of their COG associates. So they planned to take over the government over this whole, over these decades, in and out of government themselves. And they changed the plan in 1998 for it to be a response to a terrorist event, just exactly the kind of event that happened on September 11th. And then on September 11th, they implemented this plan. So one thing about that plan is that since then we've learned that it may still be in effect. It definitely was still in effect the year after 9/11, and it continued apparently to be left in place to some degree. A lot of us are not sure what that means, to what extent. And the reason we don't know what it means is that U.S. congressmen cannot even get information about it. Some congressmen have asked specifically for information on the continuity of government plan, whether it's still in effect, what it means. And they have been told that they cannot access that information. So Dick and Don have been, over the many years between the early 70s through the George W. Bush administration, really powerful figures, whether they were in government or not.
In fact, all of the other 19 that you go through in quite a lot of detail in your book, all of these people are in and out of government, but retain a lot of power when they're not in government, right? They all seem to be jumping from one company to another, to intelligence agencies, back into government. So all of these 19 people have never gone away for decades, right? They retain power.
That's exactly right. And people call this the revolving door to some extent. But I think with some of these people, it's a little higher level revolving door. One person, for example, is L. Paul Bremer, who is covered in the chapter on terrorism propaganda. He was Reagan's ambassador at large for counterterrorism, and then he went to become the managing director for Kissinger Associates, and then he came back to lead the National Commission on Terrorism. Another example is Paul Wolfowitz, who not only was in and out of government, but he, regardless of what political party was in power, Wolfowitz was always in a position of power. There are a few people over the years who have been like that. Robert Gates is another example of somebody who, no matter which political party is in power, is always somehow in a strong position in the government. And so, yes, this revolving door is definitely reflected in these 19 suspects. A guy named Dwayne Andrews is another one in the book that, led a company called SAIC, which is Science Applications International Corporation, which is just incredibly interesting in terms of the many, many links it has to 9/11. And Dwayne Andrews, as I said earlier, was the protege of Dick Cheney. He was Dick's intelligence man when Dick was Secretary of Defense in the George H.W. Bush administration. And after that, left to lead this company, SAIC. So these corporations and the government, there's really almost no barriers between them. And I think we see that today when we know that the, for example, most of the top secret clearances given out by the United States today are just to people who work for private companies. So most of the intelligence work in the United States is contracted out. And that can be frightening to a lot of people knowing now that the government is spying on all of us continuously.
Frank Carlucci, former head of the investment firm The Carlyle Group, is the third major player mentioned among the other 19. What is his history, and what are some of the companies he has been affiliated with?
Well, Frank Carlucci is most well known for having been the CEO of the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group is very interesting with regard to 9/11 because it was funded in part by the Bin Laden family, who were investors in the Carlyle Group. And they were investors and partners with the Bush family. The Bush family is very closely related to the Carlyle Group as well. So Carlucci comes into play in the book because he is very closely related to Donald Rumsfeld. He was Donald Rumsfeld's roommate at Princeton in the 50s. And since then, he's had a career as basically a covert operative. He worked ostensibly for the State Department, for the Foreign Service, as they said back in the day. And at that time, it was clear that people working for the State Department oftentimes might be these really covert operatives, and that's exactly what he was. Carlucci was run out of several countries over his career. He was accused of plotting the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, who was the president of the Congo in 1961. He's accused of overthrowing Salvador Allende in Chile, accused of being involved in coups in several other countries, and the kidnapping of Aldo Moro and other things in Portugal and so forth. So he's really considered a specialist in dirty work. And that's interesting because him being so powerful as the CEO of the Carlyle Group and having such connections to companies that actually reported through him, one of them being BDM International. BDM International is really strongly connected to 9/11, and that, again, this company Stratesec comes up because the chief operating officer and other employees from Stratesec came directly from Carlyle, Carlucci's BDM International. But Carlucci also has a history that appears to, very strongly appears to indicate that he was involved in the Iran-Contra crimes. He ran a company called Sears World Trade back then, and this company was considered a spook operation, basically, by people who worked there. It was a company that was found to be coordinating arms sales in the exact kinds of equipment that the Iran-Contra crimes involved. And essentially, newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer basically accused Sears World Trade and Carlucci of being involved in the Iran-Contra crimes. But he was never actually investigated for that. And one thing that, again, crops up, these people keep interlacing and showing up, Barry McDaniel from Stratesec, was the man in charge of distributing the weapons for the U.S. at that very time, at the time of the Iran-Contra crimes. And so he was an expert on logistics for armaments and explosives and so forth, which is partly why he comes up again in the book later in his own chapter. So Carlucci was around the world. He spent time in countries around the world, mainly in Africa and in the Middle East, and he did make a reputation, and in Central America and South America, as being this heavy covert operative, and also was involved in the AFSCO, you know, very closely associated with Ted Shackley and the people who were selling arms to Iran and so forth. So there's just an enormous amount of detail, but what we're trying to do with this discussion in this book is to show that these suspects just crop up in perfect positions in some cases to help affect the crimes of 9/11 and accomplish the things that have not been explained.
What is Frank Carlucci doing now?
So Frank Carlucci is no longer the chairman of the Carlyle Group. He left that job in 2003 and became the chairman emeritus for a few more years. But he's associated with a lot of other companies now, including primarily the Frontier Group, where he works with Norman Augustine, who had worked for InQtel. And he is also an advisory board member for G2 Satellite Solutions and for Nortel Networks, so into communications and satellite stuff. One thing other people have noted is he was also a primary advisor for Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential campaign. So he's definitely a strong Republican, and he continues to be associated with businesses at a high level, but no longer with government. And so I believe he's just kind of a guy who tries to influence policy as a private citizen. And so I think that he really needs to be investigated for 9/11 in terms of his connections to the Carlyle Group, to Barry McDaniel, to Donald Rumsfeld, and to the Bin Laden family in particular.
In your chapter on Frank Carlucci, you also go into the history of Richard Armitage, Now, he was part, I remember, of the George W. Bush administration. What can you tell us about Armitage?
Armitage is, he was the Deputy Secretary of State on 9/11, so he was in a very powerful position with regard to people coming in and out of the country at that time, and he had developed, along with his subordinate Grant Green, a Visa Express program that a number of the alleged 9/11 hijackers supposedly took advantage of. So basically, this Visa Express program is one by which people didn't even have to come into the office in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to apply for their visa. They basically just filled out the paperwork. And a lot of these people got visas, or were told they got visas, through that office and that program. So here's Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, in charge of providing visas basically to these alleged attackers. But the history of Armitage is very strongly indicative that he is another covert operative, and he was responsible for doing drug trafficking, profiting from drug trafficking in Vietnam, and he was allegedly part of the Phoenix program, which was an assassination program in Vietnam that killed over 20,000 people in terrible ways. And Armitage was also linked to Ted Shackley and the guys who were part of this private network that had been created in the 70s. So we talked about this private network being created that the CIA was having off-the-book operations conducted by other countries. But in the 80s, that actually grew. Ted Shackley was part of the CIA and then was fired by Jimmy Carter, and those people along with him that were fired in a kind of a purging of the CIA during the Carter administration developed this private network even more strongly, and Armitage seemed to be very closely associated with those people. He was the protege of a man named Eric von Marbod, who was very closely linked to Shackley and in the Sears World Trade Network that Frank Carlucci was running. So this appeared to be the group that was behind the Iran-Contra crimes and arms sales to Iran in the 1980s against U.S. law. And, you know, they also went back together to Vietnam and the Phoenix program. And so for them to have showed up on 9/11 in these positions of power is interesting, partly because of not only the Iran-Contra crimes and so forth, but the Mujahideen was where we are told Al-Qaeda was born. The Mujahideen is the group of Afghan Arabs in the 1980s that the U.S. funded and trained. And this was during a time when Frank Carlucci was in and out of government in the Defense Department and the CIA, and Armitage was in and out of government in the 80s as well. And Armitage was going to Afghanistan and meeting with these Mujahideen Al-Qaeda precursors. And so for him to have been in that position of providing evidence on who was responsible for the crimes of 9/11, and also to have been so intimately linked to the funding and training of the Mujahideen seems like a surprising coincidence. Richard Armitage was also present on the secure video teleconference on 9/11 that Richard Clark was running from the White House Situation Room. So he was part of the group who failed to defend us on 9/11. He was a man who provided or who ran the program that provided visas to the alleged hijackers. He had this history of covert operations and connections to the Al-Qaeda precursor group Mujahideen. He really is very strongly suggestive of somebody who knew a lot more about what was going on, just like Senator Max Cleland, who quit the 9/11 commission, claimed. He claimed that the commission was a sham, that the government knew a lot more about this whole Al-Qaeda group long before 9/11 and were not being honest about it.
The crimes of 9/11 are the origins of the war on terror. Which individuals and what corporate entities benefited most from the crime of 9/11?
Well, the Carlyle Group's a great example. They're a defense company that made a lot of money off of 9/11 and then bought up a lot of interesting types of companies after that. But also SAIC, as I mentioned, Science Applications International Corporation, and a couple of journalists have made it clear that SAIC, you know, more than anyone, more than any company, appears to have really made a bundle off of 9/11. These journalists, Donald Bartlett and James Steele, for example, said they're, you know, 9/11 was a personal tragedy for thousands of family and a national tragedy for all of America, but it was very, very good for SAIC. And the reason for that is that SAIC paradoxically built the systems that supposedly were to prevent terrorism. In the databases, for example, the national criminal databases where people would check for terrorists were built by SAIC. And then after 9/11, they were given huge contracts to repair those programs and to build new ones. And what they ended up doing was basically taking the money and building products that didn't work at all. And I go into that in the book to a little degree, but mostly with SAIC. What I'm trying to show is just the enormous number of contexts or connections to the crimes of 9/11 and to the possible explanations for what might have happened. So I mentioned that the company created the national databases that tracked and identified alleged terrorists. They also supplied airports with terrorism screening equipment. They actually even predicted and then investigated terrorist attacks like those that occurred in the World Trade Center. So they did investigations. Not only did they help with the NIST investigation of the World Trade Center after 9/11, but they investigated the World Trade Center event in 1993. And they had in 1986, that company had gone in and predicted basically the exact thing that happened in 1993. They played a big role in capturing the alleged architect of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They hired and were the employer of a man who was cleaning up Ground Zero with robots, basically using equipment that had previously been used for eliminating unexploded ordnance. His name was John Blitch. Lieutenant Colonel John Blitch left his job and joined SAIC the day before 9/11 and then spent his time cleaning up Ground Zero. So SAIC is not only profiting enormously from 9/11, but they were very intimately linked to a lot of aspects of the crimes, and they appear to be in position to help affect the crimes.
Kevin, you mentioned Richard Clark. Now, Richard Clark was a very major player among the other 19. Could you talk about who Richard Clark is, what his background is, his involvement with BCCI, the terrorist funding network, his relationship with the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, his relationship with the CIA. And as an aside, I found it quite interesting that Rolling Stone journalist Michael Hastings, dying in a fiery car crash in Los Angeles at 4 a.m., a very suspicious accident, it was Richard Clark who very recently came out publicly and stated that Michael Hastings, this journalist, that this accident was consistent with a cyber attack on his car, meaning that his car could have been remotely controlled. So Richard Clark is still very much among us, and I thought it was curious that he would come out with these remarks.
Yeah, he is definitely a very interesting person, and the man is a powerful figure without question. He has been part of U.S. government for many, many years, going back, as I said, to the Ford administration. And he has worked with many of the people who are suspected of having been part of the crimes and are suspects in this book, including